Hello, and welcome to Grand Dukes of the West, Episode 34, The Treaty of Troyes. Word of the assassination of John the Fearless spread about as fast as a horse could gallop. The Duke of Burgundy was murdered in the late afternoon of September 10th, 1419, in the town of Montereau-Fouillon, and by the morning of the 11th, the Burgundian-aligned royal court at Troyes had learned of the deed, and Paris received word not long after. News reached John's wife, Margaret of Bavaria, and the ducal consul in Dijon on the 13th, and on the 14th, messengers arrived in Ghent to deliver the news to Philip, Count of Charolais. Each time the news landed, the gravity of the situation was not lost, and John the Fearless's allies and family began planning for the future of the Burgundian party. At Troyes, Queen Isabeau took charge of the Burgundian royal government and began sending out messages to the parts of France under its control to tell them of the news, to encourage them to remain loyal to the cause, and to give instructions on what to do next. In Paris, John's nephew, Philip of Saint-Pol, gathered the leaders of the city together to reaffirm the capital's commitment to the Burgundian faction and to swear never to support the late duke's murderers. In Dijon, Margaret of Bavaria's actions mirrored those of her cousin Isabeau. If the Queen of France took the lead in the administrative response to the assassination of John the Fearless, the Duchess of Burgundy took the lead on the emotional and propagandistic response. She decried the foul deed and demanded justice. The Burgundian chancery, which had served John the Fearless so well in his propaganda war, now began sculpting the official Burgundian narrative of John's death and drafting letters to the towns of France, other Burgundian partisans, and foreign princes in order to control the story and whip up anti-Dauphinist sentiment. Meanwhile, in the Dauphinist capital of Bourges, the Dauphin was just as keen to put his own spin on the events on the bridge of Montereau, and so also sent out a flurry of letters and proclamations throughout France. Charles claimed that he approached the peace talks with nothing but good intentions, while the Duke of Burgundy had planned to kidnap the prince and maybe even hurt him. In the Dauphinist retelling, during the meeting on the bridge, John the Fearless reached for his sword in order to attack the Dauphin, but luckily, the prince was saved by his loyal guards. All throughout France, the battle to control the narrative raged, as the facts behind John the Fearless's murder became obscured by political necessity. And so we make our way to Ghent, to the court of Philip, Count of Charolais, soon to be Philip, Duke of Burgundy. Philip, a famously passionate man, took the news of his father's murder poorly. He was reported to have been consumed by his grief and threw himself into his bed, writhing with anguish, gnashing his teeth, and rolling his eyes. Philip's wife, Michelle of France, the sister of his father's killer, passed out upon hearing the news. And according to the chronicler Georges Chastelain, the couple was, quote, given over to moaning, wailing, and sobbing. Business in the Flemish court stopped for a few days, as Philip was in no state to do much of anything. Philip shared his father and grandfather's love of fine, luxurious clothes, but for the rest of his life, he would only dress in black mourning attire. That being said, his black clothes were still of the highest quality, and Philip was a fashion icon in his time. Just as John the Fearless embroidered carpenter's planes on his clothes to make one political point, Philip dressed in all black to make another. Once Philip composed himself, he jumped into action. He did not immediately head for Troyes, as Queen Isabeau, fearful of a possible Dauphinist attack, had requested, but instead spent the first few months after his father's assassination consolidating his power in the Low Countries, an early indication of his priorities. A few days after he pulled himself together, Philip was sworn in as the new Count of Flanders, and shortly after that, he met with John IV of Brabant, John the Pitiless, and Jacqueline of Bavaria to finalize the Peace of Vaugirard, which I covered in the last episode. Philip didn't end up leaving the Low Countries until February of 1420, But that didn't mean that he was ignoring the situation in France. All throughout the months he was consolidating power in the north, letters and Burgundian officials were traveling between Ghent, Dijon, Troyes, Paris, and wherever Henry V was in his ongoing conquest of France. So let's look at the negotiations between Burgundian France and Lancastrian France. Upon hearing of the assassination of John the Fearless, Henry V knew that he had an opportunity to finally bring the Burgundians on side. He had given up on negotiating with the Dauphin at the beginning of 1419, and his hopes for a deal with the Burgundians had been diminished once he learned of the Peace of Pouilly-le-Fort, but the events on the Bridge of Montereau had changed the situation. Now, a deal between the Dauphinists and the Burgundians no longer seemed possible, and furthermore, many Burgundians could no longer stomach the idea of Dauphin Charles, the man behind their leader's murder, becoming the King of France one day. Throughout the past few years, an alliance with the English was a dangerous prospect. For all the military might that they could muster, the demands that came with that might were daunting, and many Frenchmen couldn't bring themselves to ally with the English against other Frenchmen. But now, all of a sudden, the Dauphinists were viewed as worse than the English. If the Burgundians had to choose between the lesser of two evils, the Dauphin had just shown himself to be the greater. No longer was the big question that the Burgundians were asking, should we ally with the Dauphinists to drive the English out of France? Now it was, should we ally with the English to end the Civil War? But despite this change in perspective, the answer to that question was not necessarily yes. None of the reasons to be hesitant of the English had gone away, and in fact, the English king only increased his demands once he learned of the assassination of John the Fearless. Now he would accept no less than the crown of France. When a delegation from the Burgundian-aligned Royal Council expressed their shock at this demand, the English response was simply that things were different now. Richard Vaughan wrote that, quote, "Philip certainly did not become King Harry's man, as an English chronicler later put it, overnight. The arguments for and against an outright alliance with Henry V against the Dauphin were weighed and examined. No sentimental or emotional considerations of revenge were permitted to influence the counselor's logic," nicely displayed in a memorandum drawn up at the time. And from that memorandum, we get a nice pros and cons list. The downsides of an alliance with Henry V included many topics which we've seen before. The biggest one was the optics of such an alliance. Put simply, many Frenchmen at the time saw an alliance with England against other Frenchmen as a betrayal, and making such an alliance would alienate many Burgundians. Going beyond the optics, there were issues of honor and duty. Philip the Good, as Duke of Burgundy, was the first peer of the realm. Even if the Dauphin had murdered his father, he still had a duty to protect the Kingdom of France that went beyond personal feelings. Making an alliance with Henry while he was in the midst of invading France could be considered treason, and getting the queen and king's blessing for such an alliance wasn't a foregone conclusion, even if they were currently acting as Burgundian agents. But apart from that, there were also major legal issues that came with many of Henry's demands, specifically his demands for territory to be ceded with full sovereignty and his demand to be recognized as King of France, such as, were these things possible? Many legal minds considered these issues and came down on both sides, so there was no consensus on whether or not it was legally possible to alienate French territory or to disinherit the Dauphin, even if the king agreed to do so. With all that being said, an English alliance had many promising benefits. At the time, it seemed quite likely that the combination of English and Burgundian might would be enough to push the Dauphinist faction out of France. The defeat of the Dauphinists by an Anglo-Burgundian alliance would simultaneously end the Civil War and the war with England, and after all these years of violence, the prospect of peace was a tempting one. And just as the English alliance had its benefits, passing up the alliance came with its own dangers. In 1419, Henry V seemed unstoppable and invincible. So, while the argument of if you can't beat 'em, join 'em was compelling, so too was the threat of not joining 'em and being beaten in turn. Even more worrying than the threat of the English on their own was the threat of an Anglo-Dauphinist alliance. While at the moment it seemed unlikely, it was not impossible and would have almost certainly led to the crushing of the Burgundian faction and the dismemberment of the Burgundian state. So by allying with the English, the Burgundians could both increase their own power and prevent such an alliance from being made against them. And finally, Henry's claim to be King of France, while controversial, did give the Burgundians an important out. Charles VI would not live forever, and the Dauphin succeeding him was a dangerous prospect for the Duke of Burgundy and his supporters. Even if Dauphin Charles alone was successfully disinherited, the next in line for the throne was Charles of Orléans, and an Orléanist King of France would not be any better for the Burgundians. Further complicating the situation was the fact that Orléans was a prisoner in England, so his kingship would give Henry V even more negotiating leverage against France. Therefore, for many Burgundians, accepting Henry V as king seemed no worse than the alternatives. There were some Burgundians who thought that Philip the Good should stake his own claim to the throne. Philip was relatively high up in the line of succession, but he would need to get through several Orléanist and Angevin princes first, something which seemed unlikely to garner support in much of France. At the end of the day, Philip didn't have much of a drive to claim the crown, and if he did, he would have to do it alone, as the Dauphinists and the English each had their chosen candidate already. As the decision on whether or not to ally with the English was being weighed, Burgundian agents began negotiations with Henry V, at first for a limited ceasefire, but as the talks continued, it seemed more likely that these negotiations would go further. The people of Paris were among the most vocal in pushing for an alliance with England. The capital had always been among John the Fearless's biggest fans, and the outrage sparked by his assassination set off yet another round of anti-Dauphinist persecution. Admittedly, by now, there weren't really any Dauphinists in Paris, but paranoia always has a way of finding enemies. However, the people of Paris were motivated by material concerns more so than the demand for revenge. Henry V and his army were a stone's throw from the capital, and between them and the Dauphinist forces in the region, Paris was largely cut off from the outside world. The English king had made clear his desire to take the city, and it seemed likely that this would be possible. The Parisians were stressed out, tired, and hungry, and they just wanted relief. So for Paris, a peace deal would mean that the threat of an English siege and possible sack would be lifted. Furthermore, goods such as firewood and food could easily make their way into the capital again, and both were in short supply at the moment. But even beyond those basic necessities, the reopening of English Normandy and the River Seine to the capital would allow for some degree of prosperity to return to the city. The Count of Saint-Pol knew firsthand how desperate things in the capital were getting, and wrote to tell his cousin, Philip the Good, that if Henry V were to come to Paris with his army, the capital might surrender without a fight. Already, Henry was in negotiations with a delegation from Paris, in addition to the wider Anglo-Burgundian negotiations. And while the English king agreed not to march on Paris for a time, the agreement was only set to last for 2 months. These negotiations had occurred as Henry was mopping up at Gisors, a mere 60 kilometers or 40 miles from Paris. So the efficacy and threat of the English army was at the front of the Parisian delegates' minds during these talks. Queen Isabeau approached the post-Montereau negotiations with the English with more caution. She did take part in them, and in fact she was the first one in the Burgundian party to reach out to Henry V after John's death, but she also had much to fear from a deal with the English. Isabeau initially hoped that a deal along the lines of what had been negotiated back in May could be agreed to, But as Henry's demands increased, so too did Isabeau's reservations. As Henry's demand for the French crown no longer seemed like something he'd be willing to give up, Isabeau faced a dilemma. Would she agree to the disinheritance of her son? And Isabeau had other reasons to resist Henry's takeover of France, such as the fact that there would be no place for her in the Lancastrian government. The queen's alliance with Burgundy had always been her second choice, and as the Burgundians and English cozied up, the queen viewed her allies with more hesitancy. What Isabeau really wanted was peace in France. While Louis of Guienne lived, she supported his attempts to create a royalist party to balance the factions. But after his death, the Dauphins became subsumed in partisanship. Her attempts to arrange a settlement after Guienne's death had alienated the Armagnacs and led them to imprison her at Tours, which in turn pushed her into the arms of the Burgundians, which, in turn, drove a wedge between her and the Dauphin. But despite her fears of the men surrounding her son, and, in turn, their hatred of the queen, she remained in talks with the Dauphinists throughout this period of negotiation with the English. So the queen did her best to stall. After the initial rounds of negotiation, she decided to withdraw from the talks between Burgundy, Paris, and England. Furthermore, she also refused Philip the Good's request to be made the king's lieutenant in France, an office which John the Fearless had previously held, which gave him his official authority in the kingdom, and, more importantly in this case, would have given Philip the power to unilaterally make a deal with the English. But as it was, Paris had already decided to accept Henry's demands, and Philip made his decision not long after. The pressure began mounting as the queen received envoys from Henry V, from Philip the Good, from Margaret of Bavaria, and from Paris, all urging her to accept the deal. Isabeau was the head of the Burgundians in Troyes, and nominally in charge of the royal government, so her assent was needed for the agreement to go into effect. But that also meant that she was surrounded by Burgundians in Troyes. In the end, she did make the choice to accept the deal with Henry V, but it was not a choice made free from influence. The fact of the matter was that, at this point, peace between the factions was impossible, and Isabeau must have known that. So eventually, the queen gave in. And doing so did have some benefits. We've already talked about the general positives for France, but in return for agreeing to the deal with the English, Isabeau received a stipend, one that the nearly bankrupt court at Troyes desperately needed. This has led to the charge that the queen simply sold out her country and her child for cash. But the reality of the situation is more complicated. Tracy Adams writes, quote, "To see the queen's desire to provide for her dependents as signs of greed and collaboration is to ignore the fact that she was responsible for a household, a group of followers, whose very existence depended on her. She did not have the luxury of worrying simply about feeding herself. It is more accurate to see the queen's decision as one in favor of her dependents and against a son whose followers had imprisoned her, a son who was as likely as not to turn on her if she managed to escape from Troyes." And to see the queen's assent as familial betrayal is misleading. The Dauphin had been raised more by his in-laws, the House of Anjou, than the royal family. He had spent much of his life away from the queen and seemed to regard Yolanda of Aragon, his mother-in-law, far more highly than his actual mother, even before they found themselves on opposite sides of the Civil War. And now, he was being constantly poisoned against her by many Armagnacs with an axe to grind with the queen. Furthermore, it seemed like Henry V's conquest of France was an inevitability, so making peace now meant protecting the rest of the royal family, and agreeing to the marriage between Catherine of France and Henry V meant that one of her grandsons would sit on the throne one day. The king was won over much more easily than the queen was, although convincing Charles VI of anything wasn't terribly difficult. He agreed to the English deal when it was made known to him that Henry V would serve as his lieutenant during his lifetime, and was happy to be the heir to France rather than demanding that Charles be deposed. As Richard Famiglietti wrote to King Charles, quote, Henry must have seemed much more obliging and solicitous of the dignity and sacrosanct nature of royalty in France than the Dauphin. At this point, Charles had very little actual power left, and could really only hold on to the dignity of the office of king. He barely had any personal dignity left. In January of 1420, Charles VI issued a statement that admonished the Dauphin for his false claim to be regent of France and for the murder of John the Fearless, among other alleged crimes and misdeeds. King Charles went on to say that the Dauphin deserved no loyalty and no power, and so he would be disinherited in favor of Henry. How much agency the king had here is debatable, but the fact of the matter is that he did issue the proclamation while he was in a state of relative lucidity, and it was taken seriously at the time. This statement effectively ended whatever resistance the queen could muster against a deal with the English, further pushing her towards acceptance. So by early 1420, the Duke of Burgundy, Paris, and the king and queen had all agreed to what would become the Treaty of Troyes, the terms of which were generally that Henry V and Catherine of France would be married, and Henry would be made the king's lieutenant and heir in France. Henry would become the King of France for all practical purposes, but everything would still be done in Charles VI's name and with his seals. Henry and his heirs would thus become the kings of France after the death of Charles VI. However, England and France would be held in a personal union rather than officially united. While Charles was still living, Henry would maintain personal control of Normandy and the other parts of France that he had conquered. And the land that had been seized in Normandy and doled out to English lords would not be returned, even the lands seized from Burgundian partisans. Philip the Good and Henry V resolved to not make a separate peace with the Dauphin, and to continue the fight against Dauphinist France. Philip also received recognition from the English for the lands which his father had acquired, such as Tonnerre and Mâcon, as well as promises for more territories in Picardy. The Treaty of Troyes was signed, unsurprisingly, in Troyes in May of 1420. The signing of the treaty was a grand event, which included the King and Queen of France, the King of England, and the Duke of Burgundy. Both Henry V and Philip the Good showed up in style and with vast retinues, and about 2 weeks after the treaty was signed, Henry V and Catherine of France were wed. The reaction to the treaty throughout France was mixed. Obviously, the Dauphin and his supporters rejected it out of hand, and considered it to be illegitimate and full of illegal promises. But even within the Burgundian faction, there were many who opposed the Treaty of Troyes. Some were hesitant at first, but were eventually convinced to pledge their allegiance to Henry. But there were others who simply could not stomach the alliance with the English, and ended up defecting to the Dauphin. The most prominent of the new Dauphinists was Jacques d'Harcourt. Harcourt had been a loyal Burgundian for many years, but just couldn't support the Treaty of Troyes. This was mainly because the Harcourts were important Norman lords, and so Jacques and his family had been ruined by the English invasion of Normandy. And as the Treaty of Troyes confirmed English control of the duchy, it meant that Jacques d'Harcourt had no hope of having his lands returned if he stuck with the Burgundians. Jacques d'Harcourt was not alone in his opposition. There were other Norman Burgundians who decided to defect after Troyes, and there were also those without a material motivation, who simply decided that the deal with the English was a step too far, and that it would be better to support the Dauphin than the King of England, even if that meant turning their backs on the Duke of Burgundy. The Dauphin was keen to capitalize on this sentiment, and his own chancery began popping out tracts which tied loyalty to him with loyalty to France. But while this argument did win many to his cause, we should be careful not to assume that this was how everyone at the time viewed the situation. At the end of the day, that argument was the argument of a faction, more so than it was a national argument. In this period, the idea of French patriotism was still being formed, and would have barely resembled modern ideas of patriotism. In fact, to the people of Paris, many of the Dauphin's supporters, people who generally hailed from the south of France, were seen as just as foreign as the English were. Tracy Adams writes, quote, "The medieval notions of the nation were based on an awareness of shared history and geography, but mostly on shared subjugation to the French king. Nationalism emerges from a willed construction of a collective identity, a nation, and such nationalism is located above any individual leader. The national sentiment of the 15th century was attached to a figure, the king, not to a nation." And the fact of the matter was that the king had declared his support for the Treaty of Troyes. At the end of the day, more opposition to the treaty stemmed from the fact that people doubted the legality of the Dauphin's disinheritance than from patriotic sentiment. I don't want to imply that there was no element of patriotism in opposing the English, but I think it's important to note that the treaty was not simply the selling out of France to England, as it tends to be seen as today. That view comes primarily from the court of Charles VII, who had ample motivation to paint events in that light, and from historians of the 19th and 20th centuries, who lived in a time where nationalism was everywhere and couldn't really be avoided. Those Burgundians who signed on to the Treaty of Troyes didn't see it as a betrayal of their country. If the king supported the treaty, then not to accept it would be the real betrayal. And just as important as the king's assent was that the horrible future of the Dauphin as king could be avoided and peace could be restored to France. Furthermore, through the marriage between Henry V and Catherine of France, the Treaty of Troyes ensured that the crown of France would remain in the family. Richard Famiglietti writes, quote, "The feeling one gets from the Treaty of Troyes is that the King of France was graciously accepting Henry of England into his family, not that Henry V had compelled him by his conquests to come to terms." There were many reasons for Burgundians to oppose the Treaty of Troyes, and we will see throughout the coming episodes that the Anglo-Burgundian alliance was often fraught and unstable. Philip had a personal enemy in the Dauphin, but that did not necessarily mean that he had deep-seated reasons to support Henry V's ambitions in France beyond harming Charles. The point that I really want to make about the Treaty of Troyes is that it made sense to a lot of people at the time. It was controversial in 1420, and many in France opposed it on principle, but it wasn't necessarily so beyond the pale. The Treaty of Troyes also had an interesting effect on the eagerness of the English back in England to support Henry V's conquests. According to the treaty, England and France were now at peace, so the conflict between Henry V and the Dauphin was considered to be a French civil war rather than a national conflict. Moreover, with the English controlling Normandy and Philip the Good's Low Country territories now at peace with England, the parts of France still hostile to England were generally far from the English Channel and posed little threat to the island. Gone were the days of regular raids and piracy. Therefore, as the English occupation of France dragged on, and the leaders of that occupation continually asked for more men and money, the English themselves grew more resistant and would argue more and more that Lancastrian France should pay for the war. However, in the months after the signing of the treaty, both the English and the Burgundians viewed the future of their deal optimistically. Soon after Henry's wedding to Catherine of France, the King of England and heir to France began a joint military campaign with his new ally, the Duke of Burgundy. The goal of this campaign was to drive the Dauphinists out of the Île-de-France, and to accomplish this goal, both Henry and Philip came out in force. Henry had with him around 4,000 men, while Philip brought a huge force of 8,000. Around 2 weeks after the Duke and King set out, they reached the town and castle of Montereau-Fouillon. 9 months earlier, the forces of the Dauphin had compelled John the Fearless's men to surrender the castle in the wake of his murder. Now the overwhelming force brought to bear by the Duke of Burgundy and the King of England allowed them to take the castle in a week. The assault on the castle of Montereau must have been a cathartic experience for the young Duke of Burgundy. His father's cannons now tore through the walls of the last place he saw alive. Most of the garrison of the castle surrendered and were allowed to leave in peace, but their leaders, men who had taken part in the conspiracy to murder John the Fearless, were arrested, if they had not already managed to flee. Philip recovered the body of his father and was finally able to pay his last respects. John the Fearless's body was then sent back to Burgundy, where he would be laid to rest alongside his father in the Charterhouse of Champmol. From Montereau, Henry and Philip continued their campaign. Other towns and castles folded under the combined might of Burgundy and England, and the next major target of the Anglo-Burgundian army was Queen Isabeau's former base outside of Paris, the Castle of Melun. As the English and Burgundian armies set up outside the fortress, Charles VI was brought out to demand its surrender. The response that the garrison gave was one that we've seen time and time again throughout the Civil War. They would happily surrender to the King of France if he alone demanded it, but they would not yield to the King of England or the Duke of Burgundy. Melun was a tougher nut to crack than any of the others that the Anglo-Burgundian army had faced thus far. Its defenses were strong, and its garrison was well supplied. Isabeau had made sure of that a decade earlier, when the castle was hers. The siege of Melun would end up lasting for 4 months. Several times, the Dauphinists attempted to gather an army of their own to relieve the castle, but nothing ever materialized. With their supplies running low and disease beginning to spread throughout the town and castle, the garrison of Melun agreed to terms in mid-November. The fall of Melun was a significant victory for the Anglo-Burgundian alliance, and marked their dominance in the Île-de-France. But it came at a cost. Henry V lost about a third of his current fighting force to disease and sallies during the siege. While the siege was a victory for the English, it did demonstrate that resistance was still possible, and that Henry V's conquest of France might not be as rapid as it was first thought to be. After wrapping up at Melun, Henry V decided that it was time that he finally visit the city, which was now his second capital. So on the 1st of December, 1420, Henry V entered Paris, not as a conqueror, but as the regent of France. The entrance was both joyous and tense. The Parisians were glad that the alliance had reduced the pressure brought to bear on their city, but many were still hesitant of it, and some were still hostile to the English. The Burgundians in Paris began handing control of the city over to the English, and this was done with varying degrees of resistance, depending on the officer in question. Philip of Saint-Pol resigned as captain of Paris, and handed the office to the Duke of Clarence without incident. But many of the career officials and bureaucrats were less than thrilled to be out of a job. The English administration in Paris would keep many Frenchmen employed, but still, numerous influential Parisians now found themselves displaced. But all in all, at the end of 1420, things were good for Paris. The Île-de-France was no longer held in a stranglehold by hostile powers, and most of the people were cautiously optimistic about what the future held. Next time, we'll continue to explore the advance of the Anglo-Burgundian alliance, but we'll also see that the Treaty of Troyes did not precipitate the collapse of the Dauphinist faction. While the Dauphin and his allies were now on the back foot, and the nature of the civil war and English invasion had changed, the conflict was far from over. Thank you so much to my patrons: Christine, Duchesse de Nemours; Peter, Duc de Brancion; Elliot, Graf von Kravenstein; Anthony, Comte de Chateauneuf-Nixois; James, Graf von Temse; Preston, Comte de Saint-Fargeau; Mark, Comte de Mirceau; Diana, Graf von Biersel; Mehmet, Comte Santerre; Chris, Comte de Semur; David, Graf von Bornem; Rosa, Comte de Germol; Elliot, Comte de Bussy-le-Grand; Quentin, Graf von Blasfeld; Tyler, Comte de Chamaret; Ian, Graf von Arenberg; and to my Knights of the Duchy. If you want to join them, you can at patreon.com/ValoisBurgundy. If you want to support the podcast in other ways, you can do so by leaving a review on your podcast app of choice and telling your friends about the show. Both really help to grow the show and will earn you my everlasting appreciation. If you want to keep up with the show, you can follow me at ValoisBurgundy on Twitter or Blue Sky, or find Grand Dukes of the West on Facebook. You can also email me at granddukesofthewest@gmail.com and check out the podcast website for maps, images, sources, and more at granddukesofthewest.com. Once again, thank you for listening.